Welcome to NPR's roundup of the very best arts and culture stories. I'm Felix Contreras. Just a reminder, you can always subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. This week, in the documentary Wasteland, director Lucy Walker chronicles the artwork of Vic Muniz. Then, Christopher Hitchens, the outspoken atheist, gleeful provocateur, and writer who has esophageal cancer, discusses how he wishes he was suffering for a good cause. And director Judd Apatow is known for a groundbreaking TV comedy and a string of hilarious films. But now he's edited a new collection of humor writing called Things I Found Funny. But first,
a Mexican artist is getting attention in Los Angeles nearly 80 years after he painted a controversial mural. Back then, his work was censored because it was viewed as anti-American. Now, decades later, that same mural is slowly being restored, as NPR's Mandalit Del Barco reports.
In the early 20th century, José David Alfaro Siqueiros was one of the politically active muralists in Mexico who merged revolutionary ideas with public street art. In 1932, he was jailed for his radical militancy, and when he was released, he secured a six-month visa to Los Angeles.
Siqueiros, being the idealist that he is and having fought in the Mexican Revolution, in Los Angeles, he fuses art and politics.
Photojournalist Luis Garza curated an exhibition of Siqueiros' work at the Autry Museum of the American West. It features depictions of three murals Siqueiros painted when he lived in Los Angeles, including one on historic Olvera Street. Writer Ruben Martinez says Olvera Street was meant to be an idealized version of a Mexican marketplace.
Assiduously avoiding anything controversial or political, just a quaint ethnic theme park.
Martinez's grandparents, heard on this recording, used to play guitar and sing at La Golondrina restaurant on Olvera Street. He says while they were working downstairs, Siqueiros was upstairs on the roof painting the mural.
And my grandparents were part of that staging, like an old, quaint, folkloric Mexico. And Siqueiros was painting something that flew in the face of all that. And it was a great subversive act.
To make the massive mural on the rooftop wall of the old Italian hall, Siqueiros pioneered an experimental technique of spray painting, inspiring many graffiti artists who followed. In a 1971 documentary, Siqueiros explained he'd been commissioned to paint a romanticized, idyllic mural with the theme Tropical America.
Pero para mí, América tropical.
But for me, América tropical was a land of natives, of Indians, of Creoles,
negros,
of black men,
perseguidos y acosados,
all of them invariably persecuted and harassed by the respective governments.
At that time in L.A., Mexican immigrants and Mexican Americans were being rounded up and deported. Siqueiros' mural was a response to this and other events in the U.S. The central figure is an indigenous Indian peasant lashed to a double cross, and bearing down over him is the American eagle.
It was political commentary, plain and simple, on an 18 by 82 foot wall.
Photographer Luis Garza says Siqueiros called it Tropical America, oppressed and destroyed by imperialism.
He had the cojones to do it facing City Hall. The chutzpah of this man. How dare he? Was the reaction by some.
The mural scandalized Olvera Street officials who ordered it whitewashed. In the documentary, Siqueiros talks about having been censored.
Without a doubt, my work was destroyed because of its theme.
Ironically, years of being covered over by white paint actually saved the mural from complete deterioration by the sun and rain. Since the 1970s, Chicano artists, inspired by Siqueiros' work, crusaded to preserve America Tropical. They finally got mainstream acceptance and help from the mayor and the prestigious Getty Conservation Institute. Last month on Olvera Street, city officials broke ground on a restoration project for the mural. Photographer José Luis Sedano, one of the Amigos de Siqueiros, says there will eventually be a platform for people to view and appreciate it.
It's pretty faint.
It is. But there's still enough there that makes sense to bring it back to the people. It's still a powerful statement.
America Tropical won't reemerge until 2012, but Siqueiros' art is now on display at the Museum of Latin American Art and through January at the Autry Museum. Mandalit del Barco, NPR News.
And you can see Siqueiros' mural at npr.org.
She's a screen icon, the girl with the dragon tattoo, who also played with fire and kicked the hornet's nest, the fierce character Lisbeth Salander from the trilogy by the late Swedish author Stieg Larsson. As he described Lisbeth, she looked as though she had just emerged from a week-long orgy with a gang of hard rockers, skinny with spiky black hair, black lipstick, lots of piercings and tattoos. In the Swedish movie versions, Lisbeth Salander is played by the actress Noomi Rapace, who easily disables torturers and psychopaths with tasers, nail guns, and her own 2 feet.
Flytta på dig, jävla miffo.
It's kind of beautiful the way she's fighting for freedom, and I felt like I knew something about her when I read the first book.
Actress Noomi Rapace told me she drew on her own independent streak to find the character of Lisbeth Salander.
I moved from my family when I was quite young, and I went to a drama high school, and I always been taking care of myself pretty much, and of course my childhood and my life have been much better than Lisbeth's. But I always been very stubborn and very, you know, have a very clear will of what I want to do, and then nothing can stop me. And I think that Lisbeth is pretty much the same. When she decides to do something, she does it, and it's like nobody can stand in her way. And that it's up to you, you know, if I don't see myself as a victim, then I'm not a victim.
Well, this character, Lisbeth Salander, is tiny, but she is this coiled spring of fierceness and almost sort of a feral quality to her. I wonder what you did physically to transform yourself into her.
I put myself on a diet because I wanted to be more masculine or a bit flatter, a bit more, maybe not skinny, but more boyish in my body. And then I cut my hair and I color it black, and I did all those piercings, and I started to train a mix between kickboxing and Thai boxing for like 4 or 5 days a week for 7 months before we started to shoot the movie, because I wanted to do my stunt scenes and I wanted also to wake up some kind of aggressive side in me. I think that everybody in a way has some kind of animal inside, and it's sometimes good to let it out.
In the first movie, your character, of course, endures a terrifying and extremely brutal rape.
Mm.
And you were talking about preparing for a role and preparing for a part. I wonder how you can possibly prepare for something like that, which is so graphic.
First, you have to, you know, ask yourself, do we need this scene? Is this necessary for the movie, for... Because I don't think you should ever have like a rape scene just because it will make people talk about it. And when I asked myself, do we need those scenes? And my answer was a strong yes, because it's like the things you get to see and the way Lisbeth handled the situation and how she turns his rape and the things he have done to her into strength. And she managed to stand up and collect herself and fight back. She starts a war against him instead of against herself. So I knew that we need those scenes. And then you just have to jump into it and try to put away your vanity and all the things that can stand in the way. Because it's always, of course, it's very... Nobody likes to be naked. It's no fun at all. And you have your own issues and all the things that actually can stand in the way for the scene and for the character. And that I have to just push that away and go into the situation and do it.
Do you remember how long it took to shoot that scene?
I think it was 1 week. Mm. So it felt like we were down in hell, to say it, you know, in the war. It felt like we were down in some darker side of humanity for a week. But it's quite interesting because in a strange way, I felt calm when we were done with those scenes. I knew that I've done everything I could, and then it's possible to let it go.
When your character goes back to her rapist's apartment and gets her revenge in a very graphic way, what was that like for you?
I enjoyed it in a very strange way.
Really?
And that, yeah, I didn't expect it to be like that, but it felt kind of good to come back and to be the one in charge and to force him into all those things that she does to him. And I was a bit surprised by myself that I didn't know that I had it in me, you know. But I think that's pretty much, you know, when you're working with a character, I go so far into her, and I it's like her universe and mine almost melts together. So if she enjoys this situation, it will color me and then actually affect me as well. Peter Anderson, who played the lawyer, you know, we like each other and we respect each other. So we had a good go. We were out smoking in the breaks and just talking about other things and having a coffee and just, you know, hugged each other and say, okay, shall we go back in? Yeah, let's do it.
I'm about to hurt you badly.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, yeah.
You did, you filmed these three movies in this trilogy back to back over the course of about a year. Were you able to leave Lisbeth Salander behind when you weren't shooting? I think you'd have to. I know you have a child. You would have to go home and be a completely different person.
Yeah. Well, it's not, I can't really leave her, but I can put her to sleep. It's like when I'm going home, I have learned to put the character aside, you know, so it's like, now it's time for you to go to sleep and rest until tomorrow, and then I will wake you up. But she's in me. I always carry around my character. But she, of course, but I have a kid and I have a life, so I have to find a way to put it aside and go home and cook meatballs and spaghetti. That's what we eat in Sweden. So it's like, and after, I'm getting better. You know, when I was younger, it was really difficult for me to leave and to step out of the character. But now it's, you know, I have my way of doing it.
Do you find that even now there are still moments when she's back, when all of a sudden you have turned yourself again, for maybe just for a moment when you're angry or something happens and you're right back there, you're Lisbeth Salander again?
No, not really. I'm not so sentimental, you know. I think it's good to leave things and to go on and to say, this is it, I'm done now. Actually, it was kind of strange because when we were done, you know, the last day after the last scene, all the producers came with champagne and, you know, everybody wanted to celebrate. And I just said, you know, I have to go to the bathroom, and I just started to throw up. And it was like my body was physically just throwing Lisbeth out of my whole element. So I couldn't stand for an hour or something. And I'm never sick, you know, I'm not the person that is sick. So it was kind of strange. So I think I left her there.
You purged her in a very physical way.
Yeah.
Well, Noomi Rapace, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Noomi Rapace plays the title character in all three Swedish movies of the Stieg Larsson trilogy. The Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest, the last movie, opens in the U.S. today. He is an outspoken atheist, a gleeful provocateur, a writer who has skewered everyone from Bill Clinton to Henry Kissinger to Mother Teresa. Christopher Hitchens, one-time lion of the intellectual left, a war correspondent known for his sharp wit and legendary for a well-traveled life of boozing and carousing. In June, Hitchens was diagnosed with cancer of the esophagus as he was on book tour for his memoir, Hitch 22. The cancer has metastasized, spread to his lymph nodes. He's been undergoing chemotherapy, which has left him bald, thin, and nauseated. All of this he's been chronicling in Vanity Fair magazine, his journey into what he calls Tumor Town. I went to visit Christopher Hitchens at his big, airy apartment here in Washington. It's filled with books, as you'd expect. A copy of Dr. Sherwin Nuland's book, How We Die, was open on a coffee table. Hitchens talks about his illness with a sharp sense of limited time, also with candor and humor.
When I meet people who say, which they do all the time, I must just tell you, my great aunt had cancer of the elbow and the doctors gave her 10 seconds to live, but the last I heard she was climbing Mount Everest and so forth. I switch off quite early because I said, if this story isn't about someone with metastasized esophageal cancer, I'm not that interested. Mm. If you can tell me something about that, I'm passionately interested, but all the cheer-up stories you get told have, I'm afraid, made me an esophageal cancer snob.
On the afternoon I visited, Hitchens told me he was not having a terribly good day.
today isn't a particularly good day. No, chemotherapy isn't good for you. I mean, so when you feel bad, as I am feeling now, you think, well, that's a good thing because it is supposed to be poison. Mm-hmm. And if it's making the tumor feel this queasy, then I'm okay with it.
What is a good day as compared with a bad day?
Well, a good day is one where I can not just read a book, but write a review of it. And maybe later today I'll be able to do that. I get, for some reason, stronger when the sun starts to go down. Dusk is a good time for me. I'm crepuscular.
And what are doctors telling you right now?
Well, that there's a good chance of buying some time, getting a stay, a remission. No doctor will say that they think they can totally destroy the tumor, but I don't blame them. I mean, I'm sure if I was a physician, I wouldn't do that, even if I thought I could. And I prefer to lowball it myself, because then the only surprise I can get is a reasonably pleasant one.
Mm-hmm.
But I can just tell you that if you take the absolute aggregate of people who've got what I've got, only 5% of us live for 5 years.
You have written that you have real problems with the whole cancer as battle.
Yes.
And your body as a battleground sort of metaphor that is very common in talking about people specifically with cancer. I wonder if you've come up with a different metaphor, one that you think is true.
Well, I feel a certain solidarity with other people who've got it now, of a kind I didn't before. And solidarity is an attitude of resistance, I suppose, or it should be. So, to that extent, yes. But what I feel is that this is making war on me. I'm the one being battled, and it has the advantage. It's taken the initiative. When I go to the clinic next and sit with a tube in my arm and watch the poison actually go in, I'm in an attitude of abject passivity, and there's nothing. It doesn't feel like fighting at all. It just feels like submitting.
What's better, do you think? What's a better metaphor?
In fact, one of my sort of occasional silly thoughts is, I wish I was suffering in a good cause. I mean, a cause larger than myself, or larger than just the mere issue of survival. I mean, if you were in pain and being tortured, and you felt it was helping liberation of humanity, then you could bear it better, I think. I just feel this is the partly random and partly the sort of cancer that gets people like me at about this age.
So if it's not a battle or a war, it's waging war on you, you say.
Well, it's part of life, is what it is. Mm. I mean, it's a dress rehearsal for an important episode of life, which is how you wind it up and how you agree to face that, which is something you're aware of even when you're in apparently good health.
You wrote something, and it really struck me, it was this. You said, to the dumb question, why me, the cosmos barely bothers to return the reply, why not? Have you really never stopped to think, though, why me? It seems a very human reaction.
Well, the dumb question was bound to occur. You can't not have it occur to you, but not for very long. It isn't a pointful question. I mean, I was decided on that for a long time before, and I would be very unlikely to change my mind. I mean, I'm here as the product of process of evolution, which doesn't make very many exceptions, and which rates life relatively cheaply. I mean, most human beings who've ever been born would have been dead long before they reached my age. And I would think in most of the rest of the world that, well, I know it, it's still true. So to have been relatively healthy till 62 is to have been dealt a pretty good hand by the cosmos, which doesn't know I'm here and won't notice when I'm gone. So that seemed the only properly stoic attitude to take.
There has been a whole movement of prayer around you, around Christopher Hitchens, the atheist.
Yes.
There was an Everybody Pray for Hitchens Day. What do you make of that?
Well, there are three reasons why people would do it, apart from affection for me, which, of course, I shouldn't be churlish about, of which there's been quite a lot from readers I've never met, which has meant a great deal to me, made me feel I haven't wasted the years I have had. So it's either that or it's related to it, or it is a simple wish that I get better. Well, again, I don't want to quarrel with it. Or a wish that I reconcile myself with the supernatural or the divine, which is a large part of it. I mean, I wrote back to some of the people, some of them in holy orders or running religious organizations. I said, when you say you're praying for me, do you mind if I ask what for? And a number of them said, quite honestly, not really for your recovery, but that you see the error of your ways.
That you find God.
Yeah. Now, I find that not as easy to be graceful about, because though it's put in a nice way, it's part of a phenomenon that I've always thought of as very disgusting, which is the belief of the religious that, which they keep expressing and have done for centuries, that surely now you're dying, your fears will overcome your reason. I hope I don't have to underline what's horrible about that. There's an element of blackmail to it. And an element also of tremendous insecurity, I think, on their part. I mean, they don't seem to feel they'd win the argument so easily with someone who was mentally and physically strong. By the way, I think they're right.
Christopher Hitchens told me as he thinks about the rest of his life, he thinks about the books he'd still like to write, time with his three children and how he should spend it. And, typically, Hitchens thinks of the obituaries he'd like to write.
Robert Mugabe, Joseph Ratzinger, Henry Kissinger. It does gash me to think that people like that would outlive me, I have to say. Really does.
And he mentions other things he'd like to live to see. The end of the Kim Jong-il regime in North Korea. Osama bin Laden on trial. The World Trade Center rebuilt. Christopher Hitchens measuring his own time against the world.
The busiest landfill in the world. It's in Rio de Janeiro. Nearly 3,000 struggling Brazilians make their living by foraging for recyclables there. Internationally acclaimed artist Vic Muniz, a Brazilian based in New York, decided to turn their lives and their work into a work of art. And filmmaker Lucy Walker decided to make a movie about it. Her prize-winning documentary, Wasteland, opens in theaters today. Pat Dowell has the story.
Vic Muniz is known for working with unusual materials, sugar, chocolate syrup, car parts, toy soldiers, to create portraits and restagings of famous paintings. He then photographs his constructions. In 2006, he turned to garbage.
Garbage is something that you're always trying to hide. It's supposed to be non-visual. And to make art with something that you're always trying not to see, it seemed like an interesting proposition for me.
Early in Lucy Walker's film, Muniz says he wanted to do more than create art out of garbage. He wanted to use the materials that people deal with every day to change their lives.
My experience with mixing art with social projects is that that's the main thing. It's just like taking people away for, even if it's for a few minutes, away from where they are and showing them another world, another place. Even if there is a place from which they can look at where they are.
And where these Brazilians were, the suburban Rio dump called Jardim Gramacho, was a profoundly shocking thing to see, says Lucy Walker.
The people are right in the garbage, which you'd think is the most, and it is in fact, the most dangerous place to be. And they're just sort of stepping in it and sort of diving on the garbage. The second that the giant trucks tilt and these incredible volumes of garbage slide down.
Filmmaker and artist were surprised at the level of camaraderie and the level of organization of the pickers, catadores in Portuguese. They've formed their own cooperative to sell what's recyclable to wholesalers. But they keep things too, food, clothes, furniture. One man saves all the books he finds and wants to start a library at the cooperative whose young leader reads them.
Eu gosto muito do Maquiavel.
Maquiavel é maneiro.
Muito, muito, muito mesmo. Eu gosto do Nietzsche.
He says he likes Machiavelli, and he really, really likes Nietzsche. And he became one of the artist's subjects. Vic Muniz posed the pickers, photographed them, and then projected the photographs from 65 feet up in a warehouse covering the floor. He directed the pickers from above as they filled in the contours and shading of their portraits with broken treasures from the trash. Filmmaker Lucy Walker initially imagined she would use the music of Brazil in her film, but ultimately went in the opposite direction. using the otherworldly atmospheres of Moby instead.
To impose some sort of Brazilian music would be as artificial as anything else. These are human beings confronting waste, and there's no music in that situation for them.
Moby, a friend of Walker's for 20 years, says he did not compose new music for the film. He offered his entire catalog and told her to use anything she wanted.
She dug really deep, and going into some very obscure B-sides that I had made that had only been released in Europe, and found a lot of very obscure cinematic music that I had made that had never actually appeared in movies.
And what makes music cinematic?
For me, to use cinematic as an adjective, especially applied to music that hasn't appeared in movies, for me what that means is music that instantly transforms the space in which it's being listened to.
It does, says Vic Muniz.
Being in Gramacho at night is an amazing experience. And there's one part of the film where Moby just conveys the exact sense of mystery and a little bit of fright that you feel when you're there at night.
The landfill and its workers are a little less scary to Brazilians, thanks to the popularity of this film and the exhibition of the portraits the Pickers helped Muniz make. Sales of some of the photographs raised about $250,000 for the Catadores Cooperative. The question of whether their collaboration in this art project changed their lives is not easily answered. Most of them went back to work as Catadores, but Vic Muniz says they changed him.
I didn't know who they were. I didn't know how strong they were, how wonderful they could have been. And my experience with them after 3 years, you know, it turned like these things that were just like ghosts or monsters inside my head. You know, they're my friends now.
The landfill is slated to close in 2012, and Vic Muniz is working with nonprofits in Rio to move the Catadores into the workforce because they have the skills that Brazilians will need as the nation begins household recycling. For NPR News, this is Pat Dowell.
Our program is directed today by Rob Ballinger, edited by Corey Turner and Allison McAdam, and produced by Graham Smith. The technical director is Stu Rushfield. The engineering supervisor is Robert Jackson.
Our planning editor is Jerry Holmes. The staff includes Brendan Banizak, Julia Buckley, Franklin Cater, Andrea Hsu, Gabe O'Connor, Carol Klinger, Jennifer Longmire-Wright, Viet Le, and Rhonda Ray.
Our executive producer is Christopher Turpin. The managing editor for NPR News is David Sweeney. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Film director Judd Apatow is known for his cinematic fusion of frat boy humor and nerdy sensitivity. From the early days of his TV show Freaks and Geeks to the stratospheric embrace of his films like The 40-Year-Old Virgin and Knocked Up, there's no doubt that Apatow's writing and directing are hilarious. That's part of the reason he was asked to edit a new book called I Found This Funny, My Favorite Pieces of Humor and Some That May Not Be Funny at All. Judd Apatow joins us from NPR West in Culver City. Welcome back to the program, Judd.
It is a pleasure to be here at the show that launched it all.
That's right. I made you back in the day when you released 40-Year-Old Virgin. You hardly needed me. I'm curious about, I understand My Favorite Pieces of Humor, but I'm not quite sure I understand Some That May Not Be Funny at All. You open the collection with a story by James Agee, and it's called A Mother's Tale. This seems to be one of those ones that may not be funny at all, but did you find it funny?
I found it fascinating and interesting. James Agee was the film critic for Time magazine. He also wrote The African Queen and Night of the Hunter, and he was an amazing writer, and he wrote this short story about a cow that's headed to what he thinks is heaven, but really it's the slaughterhouse, and he escapes after they skin him alive and tries to run back home to warn everybody. And I don't know, that's kind of dark comedy in its own way.
Yeah, but what happens is, the way that I read it is the mom's telling the story about you know, she wants her calves to stay at home because that's really where the good stuff is. If you go with the herd, you'll take this train ride and you'll be fed really well, and then you'll meet the man with the hammer and the rest is hamburger. At the end of the story, I don't think I'm giving too much away because there's a whole book of stories, but it goes through the story and the little calf goes, "What's a train?" Now, to me, this sounds like the setup and punchline to an old joke where a kid asks, "Where am I from?" And the mother and father go through the whole explanation and the kid goes, "Well, my friend Bobby's from Cleveland."
Exactly.
Is that it? It's like a big setup and then this sort of punchline?
What I like about it is that you know, they don't even know if it happened. Like, now it's considered to be a myth. Mm-hmm. And no one knows if, when you get on the train, if you are going to heaven or the slaughterhouse. And there's a thousand ways to read the story, all disturbing. And I don't know, maybe it's the agnostic part of myself that found it funny.
Well, you can move on past disturbing and on to funny stories, funny ha-ha, funny serious. When you talked to us before, you said comedian Gary Shandling advised you to always make sure the characters you write are real. Did that idea inform the stories you chose for the book? I'm thinking actually of Amy Bloom's Love Is Not a Pie.
I love books where people tell me things they think I should read. And I thought, well, maybe I could do that with humor. And so what I tried to do is pick short stories that were funny. There's a great Philip Roth short story. There's some F. Scott Fitzgerald and Hemingway, ones that I found kind of humorous. Others might not. But I also put in a chapter from Steve Martin's memoirs and an article about the great comedian Bill Hicks and these strange cartoons from Iceland that made me laugh. And it's just a great way to see what I find amusing or things that I find powerful.
I want to continue on themes of writing, aside from books being recommended or stories being recommended to you, but honesty in writing. Honesty comes to mind in your movie Knocked Up. The wife, Debbie, finds out her husband has lied to her, and he said he was checking out a band for work. She finds him with his friends playing fantasy baseball. And in this clip, that's not the only lie.
What'd you do last Wednesday night when you said you went to see a band?
I went to the movies.
With who?
By myself.
What'd you see?
Spider-Man 3.
Why do you want to go by yourself? Why didn't you ask me to go?
Because I needed to get away, you know, with work and you and the kids. Sometimes I just need some time to myself.
I need time for myself. I want time for myself, too. You're not the only one.
It's not that big of a deal.
I like Spider-Man.
Okay, so let's see Spider-Man 3 next week.
I don't want to go see it now. I don't want to have to ask you to ask me. I want you to just come up with it on your own.
I don't even know what to say. What do you want me to do?
You just think because you don't yell that you're not mean. But this is mean.
Oh, brutally honest and funny.
Yes, that's my brilliant wife, Leslie Mann, and Paul Rudd. And that is one of the scenes I'm most proud of and ashamed of at the same time. It's a little too accurate, but a lot of what I find interesting in writing is raw truth and the worst sides of ourselves. Leslie will say, "How come you don't, you know, show all the happy moments?" And I always say, "Because that's not interesting. I don't want to go to the movies to see happy people. That's why people like Indiana Jones. They want to see The Rock almost crush him. Who wants to see Indiana Jones just laying around reading a book?"
But honesty is important. So you were looking for honesty even if they were recommended, some of these short stories.
Sometimes when you read something or see a movie or hear a song, you think, wow, that person's not kidding around. They're not making this to make a buck. They really have something to say. It's like watching Sean Penn's performance in a movie. They're a group of people, you know, they are very serious about what they do, and they're trying to get something very deep across, and that's what excites me.
Tell us about your love affair with reading, which began as a kid, but then you kind of broke up for a few years, and then you jumped back into the relationship again. Tell us why and how that came about, and what kind of reading is now informing your writing today?
The first real reading I did was everything by Stephen King in junior high school. And then I read a book about Lenny Bruce, the unauthorized biography of Lenny Bruce by Albert Goldman. Mm-hmm. But I became obsessed with comedy, and I spent a lot more time watching The Mike Douglas Show and The Tonight Show than I did reading. And 10 or 15 years later, I realized, oh my goodness, there's an entire aspect of life that I'm missing out on. And I have done my best to catch up. Now, that being said, I own thousands and thousands of books, and I have read tens of books. My daughter always laughs at me. You just, every time we go to the bookstore, you buy 12 books, and I have never seen you read any of them.
Ah.
And I said, yes, but one day I'll have the time.
So the profits from your book, Judd Apatow, I found this funny, is the title, is going to raise money for a nonprofit that actually works with kids in 8 cities across the United States, 826 National. First of all, very briefly, what kind of work do they do? I mean, I assume it's to get kids reading.
It's a great charity that was started by the writer Dave Eggers, and they are tutoring centers, and they have programs where they teach kids to write, and then they'll create a book with all the short stories that the kids wrote, and the kids will design it and create the cover. I remember when I was a kid, I wrote a story for my 10th grade English class, and it was supposed to be my autobiography, but I was embarrassed of my life and how boring it was. So I made one up and said I was a secret agent and how I had affairs with all of the teachers and I was undercover in the school looking for corruption. And I thought she was going to yell at me, but my great teacher, Mrs. Farber, said, you know, you're really funny. You could be a writer like Woody Allen. You could do that. And, you know, when I was 14 or 15 years old, no one ever spoke with me in those terms. People yelled at me most of the time. I was, getting in trouble for being funny. And that was the first time that my class clownery was funneled in a positive direction. And I think that's what 826 does. It helps kids find themselves through becoming stronger readers and writers.
And you just steer them toward the funny.
I steer everything to the funny because without the funny, we're all in trouble. These are dark times. We need to laugh.
Filmmaker Judd Apatow, he's just edited a new book called I Found This Funny, and he joined us from the studios of NPR West. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I'm Felix Contreras. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia.